Welcome to our very first standalone episode of Conversation Street. This is a companion episode to go with episode 406. Don't worry, you don't need to have listened to that to understand what's going on in this episode. They're completely separate, but this section we're going to be talking about the first part of the 60s,
1961 to 1964 we're talking about. And the reason we're a bit confused is because we're not actually about to talk about it. We already talked about it a week or so ago.
It's even older than it originally was, like we said before, this is just an experiment to see how you feel, because this is a nice little, well, this is going to be an hour and 20 minutes odd.
Yeah,
you can just pop on whenever you like.
Exactly. And if you want to just keep up with the street talks and save these till later, you can do that. But as we said in the episode that came out yesterday, the main part of episode 406, if you absolutely despise this new format and you just say, just put it all together in one, I want to marathon it, then let us know, because we're just trying it out for a month or so and see how it works.
We should do an advert for it, like, Conversation Street, but my way. Handy, easy, convenient, only an hour and 20 minutes long.
That's almost as long as most podcasts normally are.
I'm fed up with listening to the middle bit in the middle. I want to listen to it at the end. What's that? I can. Thanks, Conversation Street. You're so handy.
You do that.
I'll work out some more jingles and stuff.
So without further ado, here we go. Here's our bit. As I said, we recorded it earlier. In the month. Normally we'll be recording it as straight away as you hear it, but yeah, this is us a couple of weeks ago talking about the early 1960s. We'll be back at the end just to say hope you enjoy it. Right, this is the part in the show where we're going to talk about the episodes of Corrie that we've been watching on our DVDs in the 1960s. A couple of weeks ago we talked about the 1960 episodes, the seven episodes that were the very first to air in Coronation Street. And since then we've been busily watching away the 1961 to 1964 episode, which has been eight episodes a year, hasn't it? And
eight episodes
each year we've been watching. Apart from those,
there are eight episodes on per year on the disc.
They did have more.
Like, we selected.
We did not select. They select the cream of the crop, apparently, 1961 to 1964, which we've been watching and enjoying, and desperately trying to remember what happened so we can have a discussion about it for the podcast. And I do wish that we made a few notes as we went along. We discussed that like halfway through, didn't we? But too late to go back.
Trying to just watch them for fun for once, but
there's a lot to take in and remember, and
this makes you anxious if you can't remember.
It does. I've written a few notes since then to as a bit of an aide memoir today, but I think in the second half of the 60s, when we get around to watching that, I might make a few more notes as we go. But it's been fun. We talked really positively about the first seven episodes and we had that discussion. Have you still been enjoying them as much? You still been into them?
Yeah, I feel like I can't judge them as fairly as I could the first batch, because they were all consecutive. And I could see what was going on. I could understand the story. And so with this, because they've been hand-selected, they're not random. They're sort of like picked, especially for being significant in some way. Feels unfair to try to glean any kind of, or to come up with any kind of, what's the word? Idea about what Corrie was actually like to watch back in those days. Like,
yeah.
I wish that there were more episodes.
Mm.
I mean, eight per year is not very much, but don't compare it to modern day Coronation Street, where that's like a week and a bit.
Yeah, because there were like 100 episodes or so.
Yeah, so it is still a percentage, like a significant percentage, I guess, but not at all. It wouldn't even be a significant sample size if you were to take eight episodes of a year now.
No, we did have to rely on Corriepedia to fill in some of the gaps for us, didn't we?
Yeah, that was a really helpful resource, coronationstreet.fandom.com, where if you haven't seen it by now, you probably never will look, considering how much we talk about it, but every episode has a synopsis, whether that's just one paragraph or quite a lengthy explanation of what went on in that episode. Unfortunately, they can be rather cryptic, if you are not following them through. So sometimes when I do the quiz, I'm really confused about, it's like, Stan has a problem with his manager. He tells him he can't do what he asked him, and then they don't talk and they don't go to the event that they planned. And you have to go, okay, I'm not going to look back for the next 3 weeks to see what the hell they're talking about here.
Yeah, so to help us keep up, we've been, rather than looking at the individual episode pages, we've had a look at, like, the, say, the 1961 page, where the key events of the year are listed chronologically, and sometimes there'll be a few weeks go by where they don't say anything that happens, but we tried in between the episodes that we've been watching to catch up with the main events through that, and it's been helpful, definitely really been helpful, and it would have been even more confusing if we hadn't done it, but you do kind of get the feeling by watching these discs that you're not getting the full experience, and some of the gaps you have to kind of fill in the blanks yourself, really make up what happened.
I wouldn't say it was totally essential for understanding what was going on, because clearly this DVD box set is not made, you don't need a guide to be able to understand what's going on, but it is useful. I would say the episodes are still very one and done.
Yes.
I don't know whether that's an artifact of how they selected the episodes, because if I was selecting episodes for a DVD box set where I couldn't do consecutive episodes of a soap opera, I would pick the more standalone episodes so that people could enjoy the story while they watch it. So again, I'm really frustrated in that I can't actually, with any authority, talk about, oh, Coronation Street back in the day, it was much more episodic than it is now, because for all we know, everything else was very much, well, I don't know what happened.
I'm going to ask somebody. All we can say is the vast majority of the episodes that we watched, there was one story, basically, that went from the beginning to the end of it.
And it was really nice. I really enjoyed that.
I really appreciated
that.
That is way
more fun, but then again, I was going to say, it's way more fun to me than Coronation Street now, but knowing Corey now, they would probably go, let's just do a standalone week about the quads, and then I'd have to just not watch it at all.
I mean, I suppose back in the day, there were a lot fewer characters than there were now, so if you had an episode that was all about, I don't know, Emily and Leonard Swindley together, then, and you felt like, well, I'm not seeing very much of the other characters, or the other characters are being used as side characters, you could still fit most of the other characters in, even if they weren't the main players, and then I guess it wouldn't be long before, you know, it turns into, you know, the Elsie Tanner episode of the week. But if they tried to do anything like that these days and made it all standalone, then
you just wouldn't see people.
No, you wouldn't see it. I mean, as much there's already characters at the moment that you can go weeks without seeing. It'd be even worse if they made it standalone. But I really did appreciate how it gave the stories time to breathe. There was opportunity for more character development stuff, more just general having chats, standing at the bar, chewing the cud. It was really nice, relaxed kind of feeling that I got for it.
Yeah, and also, I mean, we mentioned, like, before when we spoke about the 60s episodes, the original characters, there's 20 original characters made by Tony Warren. One of them died. But
yes,
in the episodes following that, they did introduce new characters, some of them quite major characters. So, well, the episodes that we saw, so just to remind you again, we're talking about the episodes broadcast between 1961 and 1964 in the UK.
Yes, the character number certainly ramped up in 1961. And then, I mean, some years they added a few. I mean, I suppose it was similar to now. They added a few, and others they added more. So we get to talk in a minute about some of the ones that made a big impression of us and on us, the new characters, but also whether there are any characters from those first episodes that didn't make much of an impression on us, but grew on us as the 1960s went on. I wanted to talk a bit about the general production and feel of it as well in the 60s. And if
one thing that's really weird I've got to say about the set is the fact that when you get down to the corner shop, which is Flora Linley's corner shop in Corrie in the 60s, now it's Dev's corner shop, opposite there is the Mission.
Yes.
And now they've actually, the set now, they built the outdoor area for that bit, because before it wasn't there. The Mission was just nowhere on the set, because they literally only had, like, the Archie Street, what's it called, copy, with the shop at one end, the pub at the other, and the doors in between. Then after a while they added the end part of the street, and it's really funny because it ends in a dead end, and there's like a letterbox right in the middle of the street. You can't get, you wouldn't even be able to get a car down there, let alone.
It's very, very different.
Even if it was open for you to drive through, it's so narrow you wouldn't be able to.
You can turn left and right onto Viaduct Street, yeah. But it seems like that this is pedestrianised, although they do have cars going down it as well, because there's been the occasional scene on the episodes where they have filmed on location pretending it's Coronation Street. I'm thinking, you remember the episode when Stan Ogden had his Rolls Royce and he took the characters off on a little drive somewhere,
yeah.
Which was utterly weird because that was a couple of minute scene which had incidental music in the background, and it was I can't remember what the song was they were playing, but it was some oldie timey.
It was another
driving in my car sort of song.
It was another silent movie type.
It was
escapade.
Yeah, and from that, when he picked up the characters in this Rolls Royce, which he'd been driving for a job. They picked them up outside what was supposedly the Rover's Return, but actually it was
just a completely different
pub. It didn't look like the Rover's Return because it was a pub in Manchester somewhere.
They made no attempt to make this pub look like the Rover's Return apart from slapping a sign on it that said Rover's Return.
Yeah.
I loved it.
It's weird how it stands out. And the fact that they could get away with that in the day is like, you couldn't do that now.
You get to see the streets of Manchester. I don't know whether it was Salford that they filmed this particular part in, but it was very stark and grey. Obviously, it's black and white, but no, it was just quite depressing.
Yeah.
There were no trees. It was all just terraced houses and children playing in the street and women walking there, up and down with pram and things.
But I think you're right. They're saying that the expansion of the set, or just the greater use of the set, I don't know how much of it was actually constructed for the original 1960 episode, but from 1961 onwards, the fact that they showed the set a lot more was the biggest change that I noticed.
Oh yeah, they had to have the set to have outdoor fights in.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, there were a few key scenes that they had to be able to have wider shots of the street. And it's weird because even though it was clearly indoors, it was in studio, wasn't it? It still didn't spoil it for me. It didn't feel like, oh, they're indoors here. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
It felt like that it could well be outside.
Yeah, because it's black and white.
Yeah, you kind of...
And the lighting isn't... Like, you don't think, oh...
You can make allowances, can't you?
Yeah, things get lost in the details, I think.
Mm.
And because also the quality of some of the episodes is a bit poor, like the image quality.
Yeah, I noticed that. It's really variable, isn't it? Yeah. Some of them it's, like, really kind of fuzzy and...
Yeah.
And
there's, like, artifacts all over the place.
Yeah.
But it's all... I think it's all part of the charm, to be
it
honest.
It is. It didn't bother me in the slightest.
Not at all.
But yeah, I loved the set. I liked the fact that they showed you crossing from the shop over to the mission.
That was really weird. That's the weirdest bit of it to me, because the mission is so close to the shop.
Yeah, you could almost stand there with your arms out, couldn't you? With your left hand on the shop, right hand
sure
on the mission.
Two people could bridge that gap quite easily. Mm.
But that's
where Rita's shop is now, obviously.
Yeah, it's funny that when they moved to the Media City recently, they made a big thing about being able to make two cars go up and down next to each other on the street, when back in the day you couldn't have had even one car go down there. It would be a bit tight.
And they made it kind of like seem like it was a hot, like a call to authenticity, but really, it depends on what you want to be authentic. This is the thing about Corrie, is that... It's authentic to Manchester life, but also, is it authentic to the origins, the theatrical origins of the show?
It really
you can't have both.
It felt like it was a lot more of a, you know, random enclosed street in the mid that could have been in the middle of a sea of other similar streets, you know, in Weatherfield areas, whereas now Coronation Street feels like a really important place because it's got all the businesses, it's got the... It's got the factory. It feels a lot wider open, and it is a special street in Weatherfield. Whereas,
really, I feel the other way around.
Do you?
Just because of how satty it is, it just feels like here is a play about people. Pay attention.
No, I didn't get that at all. But it was lovely to see, and some of the confrontations on the street really made good use of it. And I'm thinking that particularly of the Elsie Tanner and Ina Sharples fight from... I think that was an early 1961 one, wasn't it?
Because we've seen both of their famous tussles. now, yeah. But the latter one was not in this batch of episodes that we're talking about.
We've seen one episode from 1965, and that was the second one.
So I think that they have two famous scraps, and we've seen both of them. I think quite often you said as well in your mind they get mixed up.
Yeah, well, I definitely get them mixed up. This was from one of the ones in 1961. The High Noon episodes, I think it's kind of referred to by the fans, and it was over. It was the Poison about... Pen letter, wasn't it?
Yeah.
Which again was a storyline which I'd heard tell of. It was one of the things that I appreciated watching these was coming across episodes that we'd read about so often and going, ah, so this is actually it.
I know. Oh, this is the episode. Oh.
Yeah. So in this episode, Elsie had received an anonymous letter that was criticising... what was it even about? Was it about...
Elsie received a letter about... Well,
Was it about the string of men that she'd had with her or something?
I don't know, but she's basically... She spends a lot of time talking about the war and how great the war was because she always used to entertain American gentlemen from the forces in her place.
Yeah,
Ina
would always have a go at her about. So Elsie had received this letter and she suspected that it was Ina. And then they have this fantastic confrontation, and the angles that they filmed that were impressive. Like it was behind Ina, kind of low down, looking up to
Elsie. It was very like a Western.
It really was. And then Dennis comes out from indoors, doesn't he? But I get that confused with the 1965 one, because I was waiting for Ina to smash the window with her handbag, but that didn't happen in this one. That was a really fantastic episode. The relationship between those two, there were a few episodes that focused on their spats, didn't there? There was one earlier on in 1961 where the pair of them had been arguing over Arnold coming back.
So Arnold Tanner, who was her husband, he came back to get a divorce.
Yeah.
And Ina didn't know that that's who he was. And so she starts giving it all this about her having fancy men.
Yeah, our number 11 was just like Liberty Alder in the war, basically. that was a funny episode of the first one as well, because it started in the evening. Like, the first half of the episode was the evening, and then the next episode was the next day as well, which they don't... Well, it's been very rare for them to do that in Coronation Street now. But yeah, they had a really fantastic... antagonistic relationship, those two. That was one of the things that stood out to me the most. Let's talk about some other kind of key episodes, what things that you remember that stand out to you. I remember that you've told me a few times that the one that made the biggest impression of you was Ida Barlow's death.
I absolutely love Ida Barlow's death episode. In my opinion, one of the best episodes of TV I'd seen for a long time. I mean, Coronation Street in the 60s was about 20 odd minutes long.
Mm.
I don't think is it longer now?
I don't think it's longer now. I mean, it's like 22, it's very, 24 very hours because they had to leave room for adverts and...
I know, but these days it's still... more like an episode is an hour long, you know?
Oh, yeah, because we have the two episodes, right.
So this was just like, just a 20-odd minute episode where Frank and Ken don't know where Ida's gone. You never see Ida in this episode. You don't know what's happened to her. It's like a murder mystery. That's probably why I really like it. But it's just this mystery. So it cuts between Frank and Ken worrying. Well, Ken tries to make Frank not worry about it. And then they have to retrace her steps to try to work out where she's been and where she would have gone, because she's supposed to be visiting somebody.
Mm.
Ken goes off to visit this person. And they're like, she never arrived. And Ken's like, oh my gosh. And scurries back home again. Everyone's sort of saying to Frank, don't worry about it, it's fine, she's fine, she's fine. She's probably got yakking, you know what women are like. But he, all the way through, he has this really like panicked, queasy look on his face, like he knows something terrible's happened to her. But then we also cut to the police station where we find out, well, we see a man who's wearing a uniform. I don't know if it would be immediately obvious what kind of a uniform it was to everybody else at the time. But it becomes apparent that this man is a driver of some sort, and he's shaking. he's all shaken up and he's talking about this accident that's happened, and they have the bag of the person. Then we find out throughout the episode, bit by bit, from different parts, like, well, she was missing her bag because she went to so-and-so place and she left it behind, or and what kind of, you know, and so bit by bit, all these clues to come together, and we watch the police solve this case. There's a policeman in a what's it called, in a station, and he keeps getting phone calls and people telling him different bits of information, and bit by bit, at the end of the episode, he pieces together all the stuff, and the final clue is what was her scarf, and he gets the scarf that was described to him and realizes that he knows what's happened to this missing person and who his victim who died was. And I don't think at the time, not until the very end, I think she was still alive at one point during the episode, but then she dies in hospital.
It did make me wonder, like, at the time, did the viewers know that she was going to die? Because if you went into that not knowing, unfortunately, when we were reading about Choropedia to catch up to what happened before that episode, I saw it and said, oh, this is going to be the episode where Ida dies. I wish I hadn't known, because, yeah, what if I'd watched it and suddenly realised and have it dawn on me, that would have been a fantastic revelation. But I did appreciate how that they had these scenes at the police station, and the police officers were, you know, as important a characters to that episode as Ken and Frank and the others were, and that's not something that they do these days. It's very rare to have a scene with just police officers talking to each other in modern Corrie.
It was kind of like watching an episode of The Bill where they didn't have a policeman in the scene.
Yeah.
They never do
it
that.
It felt odd. But I think there was still... I mean, Corrie was still finding its feet, that those back in 1961, wasn't it? It was saying, oh, what's going to work here? There were no set rules that they had to follow. They could make an episode however they wanted.
If you want to watch one episode, I've completely ruined it for you now. Wait a year and watch it then. If you want to watch one episode to see the power of old-fashioned Corrie and old-fashioned TV, watch that episode, because there's so much about it is just so charming, because it's also such an artifact of its time too, like the policeman ringing round and, you know, nobody knows what happened to her because she hasn't got a phone, nobody can get hold of her, nobody knows where she is, and the police have only got descriptions and you know to go
feels weird to have the death of a major character with the character not even featuring
in it. I thought it was brilliant, because it's so reminiscent also of those traditional murder mystery stories or crime thrillers that we all love, that are set at this time period in Britain or earlier, this kind of historical crime drama that we just love, because it's set in this certain time period where everything felt a bit more simple but also a lot more complicated because of that.
I one thing I appreciated particularly about the earlier episodes in the 60s was getting to see Frank Barlow more, who was a character that I really knew nothing about. I'd seen the first episode a couple of times, and to me, Frank Barlow was the guy who fixes the bike in the living room floor and literally nothing else. And it's been weird having, you know, Ken's dad, Ken, the most important character of Coronation Street, who've been following his life story. His dad was actually a fairly major player for the first years of the programme, and I had no idea just how, you know, important he was.
Yeah. It makes me laugh, though, because we see his wife die, obviously, and he was really torn up about it and everything. And then, not that long later, because we're watching only 8 episodes per year, he's trying to check up with Christine Hardman on the road.
That was, and I'd completely, I didn't know, or I'd forgotten that those got together.
It felt very much to me a case of, well, he's going to cook my dinner now. Well, I have to get a woman in. And there's also a bit where he sells his, he starts a business, which is a hardware store. Then he sells it and he also gets some insurance money. Also, he gets a load of, no, he wins the pools or something. Yeah. So he gets a load of money. And this is after Christine Hardman declines to marry him, and then he gets all this money a few episodes later, or however amount of time later, and he's like saying to Ken, yeah, I'm rich, I might get myself a wife again, start another family. And it's like, bloody hell. And then I look at like Daniel and Bethany and Sinead, I'm like, yeah, just just the men of Weatherfield, they just bounce right back.
And it reminded me a little bit of Harry Hewitt and just assuming that his, you know, yeah, I'm going to send my daughter off to the orphanage because I can't, I'm a man and I can't look after it a child myself. And Frank didn't have the child to look after or anything. But...
No, it just kind of does make you, like, women were very much defined by what their place it was in a family. And you kind of forget that men obviously had the same very strong idea about their personality as part of what their role in a family was. And clearly Frank was sort of going, well, my son's grown, or sons are grown, my wife is dead, I'll start again with another family. Why not? Because who am I if I'm not a father and a husband?
But it was quite shocking, the age gap between Frank and Christine as well. And they're not two characters that I would think of putting together. And obviously it didn't work out. And she'd been going through the ringer a bit, hadn't she,
in the year previously? Christine. She is one of my favourite characters. Like, Linda Chavesky did not last very long at all.
No, she didn't. She made a good impression on you. But
off to Canada with Ivan. And so I was left with Christine as sort of the nearest... Even though Elsie Tanner's my same age as me, I latched on to Christine a bit more because we saw her go through the trauma of losing her mother in the first few episodes when her brain, it turned out her funny turns were actually, she had a brain tumour or something and she died in the house. And Christine felt guilty because she wasn't taking her seriously. And then Christine kind of loses her way and she's very... I tell you, the reason I like her so much is she's so morose. She makes no effort to be nice or... Like, she's not, like, charming and lovely and accommodating to people. She's literally, I'm miserable, take it
but
or
she's
leave
also
it.
Not a nasty cow.
No, she's not.
And there aren't very she's many just... people who are nasty cows. No, that's what, one of the things that I've noticed comparing the old Corrie to new Corrie. So many of the characters now are nasty to her or bitchy or there's not often somebody that can say, oh, what a thoroughly nice... Yeah, person that is. But back in these days, a lot of people were nice. But like you said, with Christine, she certainly didn't make any effort to be nice. But
no, she didn't go out of her way to give a false impression of her feelings, which is what I like. She's very honest. But she was clearly troubled. And one of the quite famous episodes was in 1962, when she decided to climb on the roof.
It was the raincoat factory, wasn't it?
Yeah, because she was a worker at the raincoat factory and there was a really good scene where she was talking to her friend about what she was going to have for lunch and she just didn't care. She was like, I don't...
Was that the scene that was filmed? It was literally on the roof and there was some high shots of them and...
I'm talking about the scene before then, though, where they're looking through the fence.
Yeah, that's what I'm thinking of.
And then she climbs on the roof of the raincoat factory and she wants to jump off and everybody is just down below looking at her. And it really did we look up to see how they filmed this, because it just looks like they sent the actress on the top of a roof.
It really, really does. I mean, I don't think they had such thing as health and safety back then, but literally it looked that most of the shots of her on the roof were close up and you could see, you know, the roof and nothing else.
It's a very steep roof, so she can sort of leap. And it's very small, so it's like the length of her legs, so she can sort of perch her bum against the top and just lean back, and she's perfectly safe.
But if you were to tell me they didn't have a safety net, I'd believe you.
I would go, probably not. But
I'm sure they did. I mean, they had a shot, like a sweeping shot of from her right down to the floor as well.
They had a crowd of people all watching, like going, oh no, she's going to jump, and the police going, oh my gosh.
Like, one of the people was Martha Longhurst, and I really enjoyed watching Martha for the few years that we had her, and she was kind of watching, almost looking like, yeah, she's probably going to jump. Most of the residents there were kind of going, oh my gosh, but she was like there waiting, just kind of watching and saying, oh yeah, well.
She's like, anyone who lived in Britain during the war probably saw death.
Exactly,
and she like clearly liked it.
Yeah, it was a bit of a spectacle for her.
Yeah, she was on the roof, and then they actually ended up sending Ken Barlow up there to try and talk her down.
He kind of like pops over the other side of the roof.
This was incredible to imagine, because they both look quite nervous. Imagine if William Roach had just fallen off this roof back in one of these very early episodes, the whole thing could have just been over like that.
Yeah, I mean, I'd seen the picture of Christine on the roof before, and I just kind of assumed that it was, you know, a made-up roof, you know, down at floor level or in the studio or something, but it was actually on a roof, wasn't it? It was what is now the Great John Street Hotel, which is around the corner from the old Key Street set, so you can go and stay in the hotel, but...
Dangled on the roof.
You can't go and get the authentic Corrie experience by, you know, standing out there.
And I mean, we've spoken before about suicide and how it's depicted on the street now and how careful you have to be. But I felt that this was quite a matter of fact. It didn't feel like it was cheap or sensationalised. It just really felt to me like Christine just went, I can't be bothered with this anymore.
It also didn't feel like they were trying to ram the issue down our throats as well. I'm not criticising at all the way that Aidan's suicide was dealt with a few years ago. But
it just felt like they were going, this is something that happens to people, yeah, and here is Christine going through that. And then she changed her mind, obviously, and decided not to jump. But she just kind of looked like she was like, well, okay, then I won't do it now.
Mm.
Like, she just was so fed up with everything.
Yeah.
That she didn't care then whether she jumps off or not.
And the following year, of course, they had this Sheila Birtle suicide attempt as well, which was the famously rewritten scenes when they were going to have this character kill herself. But then when it kind of got out in the press that they were going to do that, there was a massive uproar and Coronation Street had to rewrite it at the last minute to have her... I think because she was originally going to take pills and then gas herself, but they had her in the end. We just saw her like take one pill or something, and then Dennis Tanner rescues her the next day, which I thought was a bit odd because he comes round to her house and knocks on the door, and then immediately thinks, hang on a minute, there's something not right. She's not answering the door, kicks the door down, and then finds her. But it's like,
I really liked this episode. That was very dramatic as well.
It was, but go on.
We got to see a lot of Sheila sort of looking woozy on the on the sofa and, like, staring at the clock and things, and...
Yeah, there were more of the kind of the woozy, the visual effects that we saw with May Hardman's death. But I think that Christine's suicide attempt, that's left me with a lot greater impression than the Sheila Birtles one was. I don't know whether it was because the Sheila Birtles is the more famous one, so I expected more, or whether... I feel what having watched these episodes, I know
connection to Christine.
That's what I was going to say. I got a better connection to Christine. I felt I knew the character more. I cared about her a lot more than I did Sheila Birtles. And maybe if we'd been watching them sequentially and we'd seen all the episodes, we'd have felt more about Sheila. I don't look back at Sheila now thinking, oh, what a great character she was. I feel like, yeah, she was the one that had the suicide attempt, and I don't know a whole lot more about her.
No, I don't really remember who she was.
No.
So, what some of the other things that were in the episodes, we'll just talk about them sequentially, I think.
Okay.
Yeah?
Yeah, that's fine. I didn't know whether you wanted to talk about the big ones first or in order.
No, we'll just talk about very briefly just things that jump out. So, like, I really liked the fact that we get to see Ken being, like, an annoying student-y type. He had, he and his hippie friends all made, like, ban the bomb.
Yeah, that was funny. They grab his brother David and paint a moustache on him or something?
And they were all very like, yes, let's stop this terrible nonsense. And Frank was like, you idiots, bombs are great.
Yeah.
I love that because that attitude has been preserved through time.
Mm.
The posters aren't the same anymore, but the attitude hasn't changed on it.
It was fascinating seeing what young Ken was like. And again, we'd seen the first episode and him there with his fancy girlfriend in the first episode. You've seen that a few times, but over the course of these episodes, we've been able to see just what he was like and, yeah, the ban the bomb activism. And in 1962, the episode where he wrote that article for the paper as well, criticising his neighbours, that was really stood out to me.
Didn't he write this for a socialist newspaper?
Something like that,
And then he never expected anyone to read it. But then I think a local paper reported on what he'd said and printed it, or something like that.
Yeah, and then it's Len and Harry that get hold of it, the two kind of people that Ken's complaining about when he calls them lazy-minded, politically ignorant, beer-swilling morons, basically. Yeah. And they get really riled up about it, don't they? And they try and start penning a response to it for the newspaper. But what stood out to me for that particular episode as well, which was weird, was Ken having his bath.
It was a very casual treatment of nudity in this.
It really, really was.
Because Ken was clearly naked in the bath, but having conversations with other characters.
Yeah, his dad was there having a shave in the mirror.
Didn't Albert come in as
well? He does, yeah.
And they were just chatting away.
And Ken's there in the tin tub.
Going, I'm just shaving my legs. No, he wasn't doing that, obviously. But,
yeah,
yeah, so that was
That was a fantastic episode.
Didn't we...
I preferred some of the Ken stuff in the earlier years, because I tell you what, when he gets married to Valerie after that, the character gets a lot more boring to me, and I'm not leaving the first half of the 60s with any kind of
big impression
or connection to Valerie Barlow at all. And it was after the first few episodes we'd watched her in, we were like, oh, that's Anne Reed, isn't it? I was like, oh, yeah, it is, isn't it? I'd even forgotten, but she really is, from what I've seen, just a typical, you know, housewife. She's...
A model family, though, weren't they? They were like, this is, you know, wife and husband, young couple.
Yeah.
Setting up home together.
But like the likes of, you know, Sheila Birtles or... I don't know, she just doesn't stand out to me. Some of the characters, like the Ina Sharples, the Elsie Tanners, really made a big impression. And it's like you can watch them and go, oh, I can see why they're...
popular.
Well, they're popular, why they were the big names. And I didn't get that from Valerie at all. They had a bit of a falling out, her and Ken, didn't they? And she goes off with the PE teacher for a bit, but I didn't care. Yeah. It's similar with like Myra Booth as well. Maybe if I'd watched it for, you know, probably at the time, I'd have had time to grow to like them more.
I just thought Valerie was just supposed to be an every woman, you know, like you're supposed to... And you're supposed to feel sorry for her too, because she did think Ken was quite insufferable. And at one point she gets mad at him and like throws all his books around.
Mm.
And he doesn't really care.
Oh, do you remember the episode? Boring. One of the things that I found funny for Ken, remember the one where he comes home one night and Valerie's gone off and Ken's drunk. And then he flops down onto the bed. He like goes, wee!
Yeah.
And lands on the bed and then he finds, is it a note that she's left him or something? Yeah, it has been funny watching, young Ken and family.
We got to see the first wedding on Coronation Street. They didn't show the service, but they showed Joan's wedding, who was...
That was Annie Walker's daughter, wasn't
Annie
it?
Annie
and Jack's daughter. Yeah, I can't think of any of the weddings that we've seen in that first half that really stood out to me. We got to see Jerry and Myra's wedding. We got to see Ken and Valerie's wedding. We got to see Concepta and Harry's wedding.
We got to see them getting ready for the church and pinning all their boutonnieres and drinking sherry and stuff.
Yeah.
The first one was a bit more subdued. I can't remember which one it was where we saw all the crowds lining up to watch.
Oh, that was Jerry and Myra's wedding. That was quite funny.
So, yeah, Jerry and Myra Booth, not really massively famous characters and by any stretch of the imagination now. But I assume the people that were filmed in the episode were actually there to watch the characters in the show.
Yeah.
Rather than part of the show itself, extras pretending to be...
Yeah, there were people that had gone to see the actors turn up to film some external, of the B-shots, wasn't there? That was quite funny. But yeah, none of the weddings particularly stood out to me. But I suppose you're kind of used to Coronation Street weddings now being... juxtaposed with some massive other drama that's going on, or you know, someone's, you know, the bride's had it off with somebody else the night before, and there was none of that back here, was there? It was just, here's some characters that have been together for a while and they're going to get married and it's a nice traditional wedding, and maybe you'll get to see, you know, some of the people going along there having there's been some weddings, I think, where Ina had fallen out with Minnie. There was one, do you remember, there was one there Minnie had agreed not to buy the bride and groom any presents, but she bought them a milk jug or something, and Ina got
mad
at her for going against what they'd said or something like that. But yeah, none of the weddings so far have really stood out to me, apart from, I suppose, ironically, the wedding that didn't happen, Emily Nugent and Leonard Swinley wedding.
Oh, yeah, because Emily Nugent was one of the major new additions to the show.
We hadn't seen her at all in 1960, had we?
No, I think she was played by somebody else once.
Yes, yeah, there was another, I think an unnamed...
She was referred to as Miss Nugent, I think.
Yeah, well, all the way through this, she was. I don't think she's...
No,
been...
the character was Miss Nugent, or it was supposed to be her, and then they cast her properly.
Yeah.
And so we get to see what Emily was like as a young woman.
Oh, that's been hilarious.
Exactly the same as she was like when she was an old lady.
I think she had a bit more of a spine when she was an old lady. She was utterly weedy and wimpy and kowtowing to everything Emily, that Leonard that said.
I'd only ever known her as an old lady. And I just kind of imagined that she was beaten down by life over the course of being in having tumultuous personal life over the last 60 years. No, she's always like that. She was always a bit of a wet blanket.
And see, I don't see Emily, the old lady Emily, as being a wet blanket. I think that she's grown more of a spine as she's got older.
Well, maybe slightly, but certainly, yeah, but she's still, yeah, but only in comparison. Do you know what I mean? In comparison to what she was like. She was basically a rug on the floor.
we loved any scene that came on that had Emily and Leonard Swinley. Because
her voice
were
is the same.
Classics.
Like, she's like, oh, Mr. Swinley.
And,
she's
just,
like that now. It's great.
He
it's
was like, so she, rude to her. And like, I'm the man here.
She was such a simpering idiot, wasn't she? She was like, hey, Mr. Swinley. Oh, what if we sell these glass of sixpence.
Don't be stupid, Mrs. Nugent.
But I only thought that we might sell more.
He was so condescending to her.
And she just absorbed it all, like, yes, I am a stupid idiot.
But there has been quite a few scenes in the Gamma Garments set, hasn't there? Where we get to see the two of them acting alongside each other. That was a really great partnership, and it was I can completely see her being sort of swept along with the idea of marrying him because she's like he's the
She'd
most important man
him.
in her life.
She fancied him though.
Yeah, but the scene where she jilts him was quite a powerful one, and it's kind of quite a famous shot of her in the front of the shot, and then him kind of coming in the room behind.
Well, let's
her.
Just explain what actually happened. So they were due to get married. Everybody turns up at the church. They're all waiting. Even Lucille, the bridesmaid's there. Everyone's ready for her to turn up. She is going to be given away by somebody else. I've forgotten who it was.
Was it Frank?
But basically, they have to go to the church and go, she doesn't want to do it. Yeah. So then Leonard has to come back to the house when it's in the mission, isn't it, I think? Because that's where Leonard Swinley lives.
Yeah, but I don't know whether she was there or not. I can't remember.
Well, she's in. I think that's his house.
Yeah, but I don't know whether she was in his house or whether she was in wherever she was living. It doesn't matter.
I don't know, but she's basically there waiting, and she just has to sort of say to him, "You don't love me, and I've always wanted something that I can't have, and so we shouldn't get married." And then he's like, okay then. And then
he goes off on the honeymoon by
like,
himself.
Hello, it's at the hotel. Can you change my booking to a single, please?
he's been a real favourite character of mine, honestly, for these first half of the 60s. And considering that I didn't know a whole lot about him, I knew that he was, you know, fairly popular. But if you think back to the early days of Coronation Street, if you reflect back on the standout characters, I wouldn't say that Leonard Swinley's name is going to be on anyone's or on many people's top five lists of, you know, name a character, but
it's weird how massive he was in it.
He's really important, yeah.
Because when I used to, like, I know him from Dad's Army,
yeah,
and I never ever heard anybody ever say he was in Corrie first.
Mm.
Like, when he was in Dad's Army, that was just, you know, because I was a kid too, I don't think I would have paid much attention to it, but so it's really weird to see him carve out this role. And I don't know how much of the joke of him being in Dad's Army relied on the fact that he had been this buttoned up character in Corrie. I don't know what his career was in between the two roles.
No, I don't remember.
But I can imagine part of the joke being a bit like, look at this po-faced Leonard Swinley in a comedy show.
Yeah.
And everybody's sort of sending him up. Because there's a little bit of that in Corrie. Well, like, he's always a bit pompous. Like, we haven't got to his more pompous moments, because at the moment he's still working in Gamma Garments and he's under the his boss,
Mr. Papagopoulos.
Mr. Papagopoulos.
Which is that was another funny thing in one of the episodes, wasn't it? They get taken over by this Greek bloke, Mr. Papagopoulos, and then there was they a running know. Joke for the first half of the episode that none of the characters know how to pronounce this guy's name.
Yeah.
And it's like, oh, don't be allowed to do that these days. Is it making fun of his name?
I think you could.
Yeah, but he's been fantastic. But he's the one that goes off and has the first Curry spin-off show, doesn't he? The Pardon the Expression.
See why, because he's quite a strong.
Yeah, although actor. We didn't actually get to see him say "Pardon the Expression," if you'll pardon the expression. Although somebody took
the mick out of him saying it, and I was like, Michael, look what they've done. The other thing that he has quite an antagonistic relationship with Ina as well, because she lives at the mission and he's in charge of the mission. And there's always some kind of drama about him kicking her out or getting her to move or getting a replacement for her because she's supposed to be like the housekeeper in return for free rent.
Yeah.
And he's always trying to get rid of her. And then there was a bit where they were worrying that they were going to have to shut the mission down completely. Or was that in the more recent episodes?
I can't remember.
They were going to kick out. No, that was the episode when she wanted to move in to number 11, which is where the Tanners are.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, that's in the more recent stuff. What else have we had? Tell you what, if we're on the subject of Ina, I want to talk about Minnie Coldwell for a little bit, who's been a total revelation for me. I suppose similar to Leonard Swindy, but even more so. She was a character whose name I knew, and I know that she was kind of one of the main characters of the time, but I didn't, even though we'd done a character profile on her, I didn't know anything really about her, or I hadn't really ever seen her. She's absolutely hilarious.
So, we've got Ina, who is the one that everybody will know, is the one with the hairnet.
Yes.
And then you've got
Martha Longhurst.
Martha, who is the one with the glasses on, who is she snipes just as much as Ina does.
Yeah, she's just not as famous. Ina was still in charge, but Martha would argue back, wouldn't she?
Martha was more a reactionary. Ina was the leader. Ina was the ringleader.
Mm.
And she was just the kind of second in command. And then you've got little old Minnie.
Yeah. He's just, little old lady.
Dozy sap.
She's played for laughs.
Yeah.
And the fact that she was so dim-witted, so wet.
And she's got such a funny voice as well. She's like, oh, Ina.
Yeah. She was hilarious.
She's got some hilarious lines. She's so funny.
I don't know whether we've written down any of her lines, sadly, but just to see Ina and Martha kind of roll their eyes at how naive she was. I'm trying to remember some of the funny things that she did. There was the milk jug thing from earlier. Do you remember, I can't remember which episode it was. Maybe it was when Dennis Tanner put on the Over 60s show and she gets on to go to play on the harmonium and then you can see her kind of there playing on the piano and she's just got this funny little expression on her face. But she was just like an old bimbo, wasn't she?
Yeah.
In a way, she was just so naive, and
she's the one that had the cat called Sunny Jim.
Yeah, the comedy is this Ina and Martha being so quick witted and sharp, and then she's their like dozy third wheel.
Yeah, it's like why do they hang around with her? It's really weird.
I think that they just liked having somebody that they could boss around, really. It really made me yearn to have a group of old characters like that now, because you could have somebody like Evelyn in the Ina role, but I don't know whether Evelyn would
probably just miss what we do have, and you'll say, oh, we, you know, because you've got Rita and you had Norris, more than you give them credit for.
I'd kind of like Evelyn to have an underling who she could boss around.
Yeah. There is nobody like Minnie now.
There's nobody at all. Like if you're an old old character on Coronation Street nowadays, you are going to be, you know, if you're an old woman, you will be a battle axe character. There's been so many of them through the years, like Blanche and Sylvia, and now we've got Evelyn. There aren't any just nice little old ladies who you can imagine going home and doing their knitting and seeing their cats or anything. But it was a real fantastic character back in those days.
It was weird to me that they chose to get rid of or kill off
Martha.
Because you'd think that, I guess Martha and Ina were more similar than Minnie and Ina. And you're never going to get rid of Ina Sharples.
No.
But
although I did hear that Violet Carson threatened to quit after Martha Longhurst, I can't remember what the actress was called. Was it Margot something or other? When she was given the boot, Violet Carson threatened to leave. That was when what did we talk about him last? When they brought him in and he swung the axe and got rid of a load of characters, including Martha Longhurst, and that was another really powerful episode for me. Yeah,
it was a scene that you probably everyone had seen in clip shows of her sort of like taking her glasses off and.
Yeah.
Holding her head in her hands and then sort of collapsing onto the table while people sing in the background. But the whole
if that's all you've seen,
is a lot more affecting than that.
If all you've seen is her dying, you miss.
Yeah, because Ina's there playing on the piano and everyone's... Because she's the one that always plays the piano for everybody. So in the pub, she was playing. She plays it for the mission. She plays it when they have pantomimes and things. She's always the one that does it. And it's clearly Violet Carson who's playing.
Yeah.
So they're all there having a jolly old sing song around the piano because this was Frank's celebration due for the money that I said he'd won in selling his shop.
Mm.
So he's thrilled. The pub, Annie and Jack kick out all of the everyone else, and all the regulars have a lock in, and they're all singing away. And then Martha's sitting alone at this table, and she just kind of like collapses.
Well, it's before then as well. She's going around with her new passport that she's got because she'd been invited to Spain by her family.
This was so sad. And the
few years beforehand, she's always gone on about her daughter Lily, isn't she, and her grandkids and everything, and she's been finally invited to leave the country for the first time in her life, she's so proud of this passport, and she's going around trying to show people and nobody cares,
and Ina also keeps going, yeah, you daft, you're not going to Spain, of course you're not going to Spain, who do you think you are?
Yeah, it's so bittersweet.
And she just got more and more upset as people didn't care.
Yeah.
And then she sat down with a passport in front of her and dies, basically.
It's really, really tragic.
And they think she's asleep and sort of like shake her and she doesn't wake up. And then they grab Ina and Ina's face as she just comes rushing over.
Because I think it's Len that finds her dead, doesn't he?
For all they bickered, obviously they were friends.
Yeah.
Oh, man.
That
was a kick in the gut.
But like with all the other big episodes, we didn't then get to see the follow-up episode to find out what happened. I think that episode ends with... I think I'm right in saying that episode ends with no credits music. And it's just like her glasses there on the table.
Yeah.
But it's a really somber ending to the episode.
So that was in 1964. Yeah. We're jumping around so much.
I don't think it matters. Okay. I think that was a real perfect contrast between the jollities of Frank's party and the tragedy of her dying. But you're right, it was so weird how quickly she was killed off as well, because you think of Ina, Minnie and Martha being a real power... Iconic. Yeah, a group trio. Of characters, trio of characters, but really they were only together for 3 years and then it was broken up, and then Minnie and Ina stay with the show for another, 10, 15 years or so after that, and it'll be funny seeing them go off, just two of them.
Yeah.
Especially with Minnie being so wet.
Still works, but it would have been better if they had kept her on.
Mm-hmm. But yeah, that I think for me, that was easily one of the best episodes, one of the most... affecting ones, the lead up to her dying. I was just going to say, but I did enjoy some of the comedy stuff as well.
Are you talking about Dennis's concert?
Dennis's concert was one of the early ones that really stood out to me.
Really, the thing about Coronation, watching old Corrie, is that it really just surprises you, and it manages, and it's really frustrating because you can't do this anymore on television. Not just because you're a soap that's been around for 60 years, but because of the sheer amount of television that's happened that isn't Coronation Street. Nothing surprising anymore, really.
Mm.
You have to be quite outlandish. The thing that was the most shocking in this episode was...
The sea lions.
Yes.
Although it wasn't shocking because I'd read about it and it happened and I knew that it was going to happen. But it was hilarious that they had this pair of sea lions on the show. Dennis was putting on a show because he's Mr. Showbiz, isn't he?
Yeah.
He puts on a show at the Mission Hall for the over 60s. And this episode was filmed in the middle of the Equity Actors strike as well. So they were on a really reduced number of characters. They could also not have any even guest characters on. So there was a 12, 13... actors who had to carry the show for a good number of months.
And so they kept talking about the Blue Streak Rockets, who were supposed to be like a troop of dancers.
Yeah, sort of questionable morals. But they were talking about how they were entertained by Albert Tatlock. And in the end, they go to sleep in Jack and Annie's bed, because Annie and because those two have gone out for the evening and
yeah.
and they're not supposed to come back. But the whole episode, because it's such a Dennis,
it's a farce, isn't it?
It is, because it's never a see Dennis the concert. Centric episode.
It's just Dennis running around putting out fires that he started.
Yeah.
Like, there's chaos everywhere. He can't coordinate everybody. He's got all these acts that, and they're running around. You never get to see any of them. Yeah. It's just Dennis running around.
And like I said, he was my favourite character.
Yeah.
From this block of episodes that we've watched. But yeah, the very end of the episode, he thinks that Jack and Annie aren't going to be back in the Rover, so he manages to get the key from someone or other, goes upstairs, but then
they were supposed to go in a hotel, weren't
yeah
they?
But then they come back and then Annie walks into the bathroom and the sea lions that Dennis has got for his act are sitting around there in the bath, and the look on Annie's face is just priceless. And then meanwhile Jack's finding sort of off screen the Blue Street Rockets. That was a really fantastic
yeah, because when you hear, like, oh, the bit in the corridor
variety
where they had
episode,
the sea lions in the bath, you think it would have been like, Jack, there's sea lions in the bath. Oh, so what? And then that's the end, you don't get to see them. But no, they were in the show.
Yeah.
Because I guess they were like, well, the actors won't be in it, so let's get these sea lions.
Exactly. And there were a few episodes in this box set that were, you know, show episodes, weren't they? For example, there was the Annie Walker's This Is Your Life that they did at the end of...
Oh, yes.
Was that like the Christmas 1963, 1964? I can't remember episode. And that was a really memorable one for me, because it kind of starts off where everybody on the street are talking about, or you hear that they're doing a... that somebody's organised a This Is Your Life for somebody on the street, but nobody knew who it was.
Well, because part of the thing of This Is Your Life is you're not supposed to know in advance that it happens, and if you find out, they cancel it. And I was really confused, because obviously This Is Your Life is a real TV show,
yes,
that did talk about real people's lives, not just celebrities like in later years, but originally it was like a mixture of like notable people who were distinguished in some way, not just because they're a TV
but
presenter.
this was Dennis Tanner just doing a nice Christmas community thing of doing one of Annie Walker. And there's a funny scene earlier on in the episode where Elsie is saying, you better not have done one of me, I'm not going to show up if you're going to do me, and everyone's kind of wondering who it is. But then when they're all there in the Mission Hall and Annie gets called up, and she's a bit shy at first, but then she totally embraces it, and like by the end of the episode she's singing a duet with somebody on stage that's like some guy from her past.
Well, they had to all come up and talk about her life, didn't they? That's the part of the show, is that people from your life come up and talk about their experiences. And Ina had to do that, and she was like saying, was Minnie Martha still alive?
Yeah,
she was like saying to them, you know, we've got to get into the spirit of it, because she's obviously quite a grumpy woman, and she probably didn't think that Annie deserved it, but she had to get up on stage and perform or something.
Yeah.
I can't remember.
They also had the guy on who was led the horse around when Annie Walker was the Weatherfield Lady Godiva back in her youth, wasn't it? And they showed a picture of this topless lady from the back on a horse, and Annie Walker was really ashamed that
she was didn't have a bra on.
I know, it's very rude. That was a funny episode. But then they also had pantomimes. They did
a play in a mission, which was
they did a play, didn't they?
Really, the trouble about Coronation Street back in the 60s when they did a performance, they make you watch it. They don't just in theory have a TV have a play. Or, like, show one scene where something else happens to disturb the action, which isn't what happens in Corrie now. Like, oh, we're having a panto. Oh, but Mr. Beckham's been sick on everybody. Oh, we're having a panto. Oh, but the person who's playing Mary's having a baby.
Mm.
Like, no, that you watch the play that they put on and you like it.
Yeah, pretty much. So this is the panto. This is the last episode on the 1964
Well, I was talking about the play more. They had a whole involved play. And Emily basically said, let's make a play and I would be the main person. And then when they did it, she was like, I don't want to do it anymore. And then they made her do it anyway.
On the panto, Emily was one of the main people as well. And I just remember Emily Bishop's legs, or Emily Nugent's legs as well.
Yeah.
Because she was Dandini.
And Elsie Tanner both had legs for days in that episode.
They did.
They were both dressed up as princes, which in the spirit of panto meant that you were a very short dress because you're a woman. And they also had a dame, but I couldn't work out which character was playing that.
No, there were a couple of characters that kind of came into it towards the end, it's like, I don't really know who you are. There was that Charlie, someone or other.
They were, and they basically looked like they had a bunch of people, like random children or like people.
I found out about this. This is children from the Wood Street Mission, which is like a charity. For homeless children or something like that. It was set up in 1868 and it's still going strong to this day. So they got a load of children. I don't know whether they were like orphans or homeless children or what, and they shoved them all in the set.
They just made them watch it.
It made me wonder, did they actually put on the whole pantomime for them, or did they have to sit and watch, you know, bits of a pantomime? Because they obviously the panto was longer than the 25 odd minutes that the show gave.
Well, they had a sing along and everything.
Yeah, it was funny. It was we remarked on that with the 60s episodes, didn't we? That sometimes they would just have like a choir singing, and the action would stop, and we were going to sit and watch this. Boys, and it was the same here, just everybody having a jolly sing-along. Speaking of singing as well, we also got to see snippets of the Walter Potts / Brett Falcon character, didn't we? And he was sort of 1963 or so, which didn't really hit the mark for me.
No.
But this was one of Dennis Tanner's, when he was working on the talent agency, one of the acts that he'd found. And in real life, the singer kind of springboarded his career off of playing this guitarist on Coronation Street. But that was...
It was so just inspired by the Beatles, because obviously...
It really was. It was very cheesy in 60s and Beatles-ish, like you said.
Yeah, because obviously by like 64, the Beatles were internationally famous.
Mm.
And this was around the time that they were getting to be massive. And they were kind of local because they're from Liverpool. And so it was like Coronation Street doing, I'm trying to think, Harry Styles, like Chesney becomes Harry Styles. Yeah. No, or like they just get...
They just Chesney, find one.
Yeah, just... And he was... He performed songs and I think that... I don't know if they're original or what, but...
I think he had an original song which he launched as a single.
In the style of early Beatles songs.
Yeah.
Like, la, 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 singing
my... There was one episode where they go off...
I could have been in the Beatles.
There was one episode where they go off to New Brighton for a darts tournament, and there was a scene set in a pub there where Walter Potts just stands up and sings his song for a bit. And that was a weird episode as well.
I want to talk about that episode. Well, because it was all the men went on a jolly together to New Brighton, and I had to look up what New Brighton was, only being familiar with the one near me, which is the original Brighton. And it's basically what's it called, like a seaside resort that was made by a guy who'd thought Brighton sounds cool, let's make it New Brighton, like in the 19th century, and then it sort of grew from there.
Yeah,
but they don't think I've ever been to it again.
No.
But it's kind of like a Blackpool kind of deal, but all the men just go, don't they? And then at the beginning of the episode, the most important thing that they have to do is get all the beer on the bus. They've got stacks and stacks of beer because Jack's coming too, so he's got all these bottles of beer and they've got all these crates of beer and they're loading it onto this coach. And on the way back, the coach breaks down and everybody pours out of the coach.
And this is supposed to be set at like 4 o'clock in the morning as
well.
Yeah,
so they've gone off.
And all the women folk are back in the Rovers waiting for their men
to turn up. So they've all gone off to New Brighton, got drunk, came back still drunk, got off the coach because it broke down, and then started fighting each other.
Yeah.
And then the police have to come, and the police, you get to see shots of the police cars turning up to come and calm everybody down. And it was clearly just filmed during the day.
Yeah, and then they just went, black and white, you can get away with it.
Just shove a filter on it, they won't know. It's like, no, it doesn't look like it was filmed at night.
That was a weird episode.
Yeah, and basically it just dissolves into chaos and they all have a punch up.
There's a couple of other kind of
things. I never find out who gets arrested or anything.
Yeah, somebody gets carted off into a car. I can't remember whether one of them was Alf Roberts, who was another character that... I was hoping to see more Alf Roberts, having been sort of enjoyed him in the 80s and 90s, but he's a really kind of minor character back in these early days, wasn't he? Like, he was a friend of Len that turns up every now and then, so I guess we'll see more of him in the future episodes. But I was going to say, there's a few episodes that's Let's All Go on a Trip. Unfortunately, the Blackpool episode, which was filmed on location, and it had the musical You know the famous Coronation Street scene from 1961 where they go to Blackpool and it's "I Do Like to Be Beside the Seaside" being played, and because they couldn't film any dialogue there. That wasn't on the disc, but they do have another Blackpool trip in either 61 or 62, but that wasn't filmed in Blackpool.
It was them in front of
a backdrop. But they also have an episode where they have a drive out to the park in a fancy car, which ends up going into the lake.
Yeah, that was the Hewitts.
Yeah.
And then Ina. Didn't Ina invite herself or something? I can't remember.
I can't remember whether it was that episode or another episode, but Ina and Minnie and Martha go off to a different park, and they're watching a band play the Alleluia Chorus or something, aren't they? And then Ina, because Ina's had a broken ankle or something, she was resting up, and she gets left out by Minnie and Martha, who go to a cafe, and then the heavens open and Ina gets rained on, doesn't she? And there's some funny scenes with her trying to shelter underneath her her coat in the rainstorm.
Chewing a wasp.
Yeah.
That was the episode that made Cliff Richard...
Oh, yes, it was, wasn't it?
...stay on a diet for the rest of his poor life.
Yeah, because Minnie describes Cliff Richard as being a tubby little boy.
Lovely chubby lad.
That was funny. Right, what about, because I can't, we're running long already on this, but this feels like there's so much more to talk about. Have we even mentioned the Ogdens yet?
No.
Who are, all the way through this disc, I was looking forward to the Ogdens arriving.
Yeah, because Frieda slash Irma came first, and she was working in the corner shop, and she didn't want anybody to know her, less than desirable roots.
Mm.
Then the rest of the Ogdens pitch up, and originally there were supposed to be masses of them, but in the end, only a few arrived.
Yes, this was all to do with the another strike that went on in the summer of 1964. We saw the first episode where Hilda and Stan buy the house, and that was a funny one as well, because they had Mr. Wormold, the landlord, whose his thing was that he didn't remember any of the characters' names. Did he was like, yes, Mr. And then they make a real big impression on the neighbours, and it's almost Battersby like saying you don't know what's hit you when now the Ogdens have rocked up on the street.
Which house did they move into?
Into the 13.
Who was there?
No. They're 11. It had been the Hardmans, and then after that, I think the Booths moved in for a little bit. But Myra had spent a load of money on catalogues or something, and then they had to move out. I don't think we got to see any of that. I think I just read it. But they had that first entrance with a bang. Yeah. But yeah, the story is that their daughter turned up first, and her name was Frieda, but she changed it to Irma, and then in the first episodes they're kind of mixing up and calling her by her old name or something, aren't they?
Yeah, and Stan is such a bore, isn't he? Like, as in a boorish kind of guy. Yeah. He's like this big, fat, oafish guy who just is such a useless waste of space, and we see some of his famous job swapping in these discs where he's just can't keep a job, like you said.
He's like a Homer Simpson.
As a chauffeur, and then he wanted to get a milk round because he said he wanted to get up early and then finish before just in time for the pubs to open. And you've got Hilda.
I was just gonna say, they really hit the ground running with those characters, didn't they? What you know and love about Ina and Stan from later episodes, if you've only seen it. Hilda and Stan, from the later episodes, if you've only seen them in, say, the 70s or the 80s or whatever, they're like that right from the beginning. There are some characters that you could just say, I know why you were popular. They both lit up the stage of the screen, especially Hilda,
with her
curlers in and her funny voice. And
she was just fantastic. I want to say this now, fantastic. Even though it's not actually, we're probably going to talk about it more, but it was so funny because she was around for the second fight between Elsie and Ina, and one of the things that made me laugh so much was the fact that she was booing.
Oh yeah, she was.
And they were going, shut up, it's not, you're not supposed to, it's not a show. And she's going, no, and like she was treating it like it was a panto. I thought that was brilliant.
She was hilarious. She's just so sparky and bright-eyed. And
but she, it's funny because pretty much all the characters on the show apart from Ken, I would say, would describe themselves as being salt of the earth, down to earth, character, you know, good honest folk.
Mm.
But they probably look down their nose at Stan and Hilda, because they were obviously of an even lower class, because of the way they act. Like, they were very free, like, they didn't have as good manners as everybody else. Mm. And I think that was part of the... And that's why you likened them to...
Vettisbus. Yes. Yeah, totally. But they wanted them to arrive with a splash, and they really did. And even, like, in the later in 1964, they had the whole episode revolving around them, because with their Stan's wrestling match, which is another fantastic episode, which I didn't really know very much about. I think I'd probably seen a picture of him in his, you know, wrestling outfit on Corrypedia at some point, but I didn't know anything that happened. But that was brilliant, with him trying to get out of it, because he realizes that he's going up against this giant.
He gets fired from being a chauffeur, because we saw him take everybody out in the car. That's when they had the musical car ride with a fake Rover's Pub. Because of that, he got sacked, and so he had to get another job. And one of the jobs he got was being a wrestler.
Yeah, and
wasn't he against a Scots?
He was against some Scots. He was Ogden the Terrible, and I can't remember what his opponent was, but it was this massive, huge, Scotsman,
beefy guy.
And he tries to get out of it, but in the end, he has to go through this match, and he gets thrown off of the stage and into the audience, isn't he? And that's another funny mini scene, because she was there, she'd come along. I think Ina had refused to go along to this match because it was below brutal, her.
Yeah.
But Minnie had gone along. I can't remember who she sat next to, but she was spent the whole thing averting her eyes because it was too violent for her.
Yeah,
and meanwhile, and this is another classic scene, Ina was getting drunk in the Rovers with Annie Walker, and the episode ends with the two of them singing Drunkenly Away.
Yes, that's right.
And that these two characters that are usually at loggerheads. I know it's usually Ina and Elsie who are the enemies, but Annie would look down her nose at anybody.
Yeah, because wasn't Annie kind of feeling like
she was annoyed that Jack had gone along to see the wrestling.
Wasn't she mad that she didn't get first place in a singing competition?
That was probably around the same time, wasn't it?
And she was trying to prove that she could sing.
Yeah.
And she spent the whole time singing, and Ina was just like drunk enough to humour her and join in.
Yeah. But that episode was brilliant. That had another great Dennis Teat scene as well, because he's kind of partly involved in organising it.
Yeah.
And there's a bit where he steps into the ring and he thinks he's the only guy there. This is at like the Viaduct Street Sporting Club or something it was called. And he goes and does this little boxing routine. He's like commentating on himself. And
he's such a ham.
He really was that fantastic.
Love him.
I think we may have kind of covered most of the main bits.
So
I don't know whether there are any other characters that we've overlooked. I'm not
sure.
Well,
we got new characters. We got the Ogdens, we got Emily, we got Len, we got Alf, we got Valerie, and we got Jerry,
who we've kind of talked a bit about. Len was a funny one for me, because I, in my head, Len was a character that I didn't like, and from the little that I'd seen of him in the 80s, he rubbed me up the wrong way. He's the kind of, you know, tough buildery guy that I don't really like in Coronation Street. But watching him, especially with his relationship with Elsie Tanner developing, I found myself liking him more.
Yeah.
And I was trying to resist, like, saying, no, I don't like Len Fairclough, but he's quite charming, actually.
The show needed him as well, because apart from Ken and Dennis, even though Len was the middle-aged guy, he was like one of the youngest ones around.
He came across as being almost a leading man kind of character as well. He was a main character, and alongside
everybody else was much older and all married and everything, and he was always flirting with Elsie too.
Mm. Elsie continued to steal every scene that she was in.
Amazing.
Just what a revelation. Straight away in the 60s episode, the 1960 episodes, she stood out to me, but it just carried on. And this is one of the things that I'm most grateful for watching these old episodes for, is just seeing what it was about Elsie Tanner that everybody said was so brilliant, because I'd seen so little of her before. But straight away, she stands out to me. She was fantastic.
It's not very controversial or original opinion to say Elsie Tanner was an amazing character, but
no.
I think sometimes you hear something so much, you just kind of don't really listen, but
yeah.
Classic.
Yeah. A couple of the minor characters that stood out to me were, I really liked Doreen Lostock, and we did get to find out that it was Lostock and not Lowstock.
Yes.
And she was only in a few episodes. She worked with Emily and Gamma Garments, didn't she?
Sure.
She had amazing hair.
She had very... It was like big she eyes. Wanted to be the tallest person and she couldn't do it with her body, so she did it with her hair.
Yeah, and she was by no means a main character, but she was kind of bright and bubbly, and it's a shame that she's gone off now. She has left the show, so we're not going to see her again, but she was really good. I also... talking of really minor characters, do you remember that Cockney barmaid in the 1961 episode? She was in episodes that we saw called Nona. And her story was that she ended up leaving because none of the locals could understand what she was saying.
Which I guess was supposed to be a dig, wasn't it?
Yeah, yeah.
At the fact that they were always left out of TV.
Mm. I don't know whether any other characters really, really stood out to me. If I was going to say who are my favourite characters of the disc, I'd say Dennis Tanner.
Yeah, Dennis.
Ina, Minnie.
Yeah.
Hilda by the end of
Christine
it.
Christine for me, even though she's hardly in it.
Yeah, there's some...
She lives in Southampton.
You're right, she does. But yeah, that was about it. There were some episodes that I'd heard of that sadly weren't on the disc. For example, that Blackpool one that I said earlier on, we didn't get to see.
Because Harry Hewitt can propose to Concepta Riley.
I know, I didn't get to see that. There was an episode also in 1961 where the residents all have to shelter in the mission hall when a gas mains explodes, and I can imagine that was a nice little character. A lot of great discussion and conversations that went on in that episode. And there was another one similar to that where, do you remember when they had the episode when they found a bomb underneath Albert Tatlock's patio, and that's the cliffhanger at the end of the episode? The following episode, they're all evacuated to the mission cellar, and I would quite like to have seen that. And also, they didn't show Rita's first appearance. There were a few first appearances of characters that they didn't show, but mostly for the rest of them, we saw them later on, but we still haven't seen Rita, have we? I don't think she even comes back into the show until either late 60s or early 70s even. So we missed her.
Yeah, so she first appeared on 2nd December 1964 as one-time appearance as Dennis Tanner's friend. So she really should have made more of an effort to make sure he didn't get run over by an ambulance, because she's only in the show because of Dennis.
Him. Exactly, exactly.
So let's be grateful, shall we?
Yeah.
Be a bit humble, Rita. There's one thing Rita ain't is humble.
So that's about it. And I hope for the people listening to this, we've been going all over the place just as new ideas have popped into our heads.
I hope that it accurately portrays our enthusiasm and love for the episodes that we've seen, rather than just coming off as confusing.
The vast majority of episodes, there's something that we've kind of grabbed onto and gone, yeah, I can see why this appeared on the disc. This was a classic episode. Every time there was one that came up where I was like, that didn't really hit the mark for me, which there were a few of, it was a bit of a shame because it felt like, this episode might have taken the place of, you know, another one that could have made a bigger impression. But on the whole, because they were cherry-picked, there were some really, really fantastic episodes. I'm so glad that we've been able to watch them, and I'm excited to watch the second half now, because it's been 4 or 5 days since we've watched the last episode.
Addicts. It's almost like we're watching it like they had to in the olden days.
They had to wait to watch something.
Before the internet, when there were only two episodes of Corrie a week. Can you imagine?
But I'll just say again, if you are a Corrie fan and you haven't seen any of these 60s episodes and you're kind of waiting and thinking, I don't know whether that was for me, I implore you to get a copy of this DVD. Or look online on YouTube, because there are some that have been uploaded there. They really are fantastic.
And they have them for the 70s.
There's box sets for the 60s, 70s, 80s, 90s and 2000s.
I really do wonder whether I'm going to like any of the other ones. I think I'll like the 70s, but when it comes into the 80s, I don't know how I'm going to...
It feels more historical, doesn't it, what we're watching? It feels
like I'm watching something that's significant and has cultural value, which goes to show you as to why things like this get chucked away, because the same thing is going on now. Corrie now is the same way. Whether you probably think that's a stupid thing to say, but in 50 years' time, same thing will happen.
I think, like, because it's in black and white and everything, it just makes it feel like you're watching something special of another age. And I think by the time we get to the 80s, even though it'll be worlds away from what Coronation Street is now, it will feel... an early version of what we're watching at the moment. This feels different enough.
I hate to tell you this, Michael, the 80s were a long time ago.
I know. So I think with that, we better move on. We've been blathering on about this long enough.
Let's move on.
Maybe we can watch another episode from the second half of the 1960s before we go to bed tonight. Hope you enjoyed it.
Hope you enjoyed it.
Told you I'd say that. Yeah.
Did you remember who was going to say that? Were you waiting for an hour and 17 minutes for that to happen?
So we're currently in the middle of 1966, aren't we? Or we're in 1967
We've
now
been
in
trapped
episode.
In time. Please send help.
1966 episodes we're watching at the moment.
We've buried money on the corner of Weatherfield. Come and dig it up if you hear this message.
Unexpected windfall. I mean, they do like them on Coronation Street,
makes
don't
sense.
They? Yeah, so we'll be talking about the second half of the 1960s. Probably sort of... late March, early April, I guess, if you've been enjoying this,
then
you'll be able to listen to it.
So you can listen to it anytime.
Exactly, and if you absolutely despise that,
times.
Then you don't have to listen to the second half of it, but it's up to you.
It's up to you. But we're giving you the freedom.
Yes, that is the end of episode 406, unless you're listening to this in some very strange order.
The thing is, you can laugh in a field and run around with your white clothes on and stuff, just like... Men won't understand the freedom that you feel as a woman when you're on your period, but you can do whatever you want, even if you normally couldn't do it. Tennis, trampolining, eating yogurt, laughing at a salad. Yes, horse riding. All of those things. Wow. We've opened the whole world up to you now.
Why are we talking about periods?
Because it gives you freedom.
Oh, like our new podcast format.
Yes.
I get it.
With wings.
Like Red Bull.
No,
this is getting weirder and weirder.
Like
this analogy. I think it's time to end this podcast. If you've got any comments or feedback or anything, give us an email at conversationstreet@gmail.com. We're available on loads of other social media bits as well, but we won't bore you with all that details now because you probably know already.
Done.
This is our outro done. We will see you next week. The music for this episode came from podcastthemes.com.